Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Over this past weekend, there were 15 drug overdose cases in Fall River. In a span of 24 hours last week, there were 15 in the city of New Bedford. These are just two recent headlines from what many are calling a burgeoning public health crisis across this state and the region. Last month, Massachusetts State Police reported that at least 185 people died from suspected heroin overdoses in Massachusetts in less than 4 months, beginning last November. That number doesn't include cases from the state's three largest cities, Boston, Springfield, and Worcester. So these numbers tell a grim story. But it's important to remember that behind the numbers, there are families, real people, coping with real losses and grief. And some of these people say the deaths of their loved ones offer important lessons about the shortage of treatment, about the stigma of drug addiction, and about how opiate addiction can hit anyone, regardless of race, class, or neighborhood. So we're going to spend a little time now talking about these lessons with some people who know a lot about them. Louise Griffin's son, Zachary, was a promising high school athlete from Lowell. He became addicted to pills, then heroin. 8 months ago, he died of a morphine overdose in a Florida sober home. Now, since her son's death, Louise Griffin has established a Lowell chapter of the support group called GRASP. That stands for Grief Recovery After a Substance Passing. And Louise Griffin, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
And let me just say with all sincerity that I'm very, very sorry about the loss of your son, and we're grateful that you're in here to talk about what has to happen going forward. So thank you. Also with us from Rainham is Joanne Peterson. She's the founder and executive director of Learn to Cope, a support group for parents and family members of those struggling with addiction. Her son has been in recovery for 8 years. And Joanne Peterson, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me as well.
And listeners, we want to hear from you. Are you a parent, a sibling, a friend of someone struggling with opiate addiction? What are the treatment options that you find out there? What can lawmakers do to reduce overdose deaths? What do we need to understand about opiate addiction that gets overlooked too often? Give us a call at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. And Louise Griffin, if I could, let me start by asking you, tell us a little about your son, Zachary, and how he first started using opiates. What happened?
Zachary was a great son. He was a great athlete. He was my son. He was also a brother, a nephew, and a cousin. When he was about 17 years old, he hurt his ankle, and he was a hockey player. Of course, the kids want him back on the team, and I think he was introduced at Percocets at that time. Don't think it was ever anything done with malicious intent. Actually, matter of fact, I know it was not done with malicious intent. My son tried Percocets. He liked Percocets. He liked the way they made him feel. During his senior year in high school, he advanced from Percocets to OxyContin, and eventually it led to his use of heroin.
I see. So when did you notice something was wrong? Because I assume that when he started, it was he probably flew under the radar a little bit.
Yeah. I think that's one of the most frightening things about the prescription pill epidemic. As a parent, I had always looked for signs. And, you know, frankly, at least when I was growing up, alcohol was more of an issue than drugs. So I would look for alcohol signs of, you know, drunkenness or something like that, never saw it. With prescription pills, though, it's such a slight and subtle change that you don't really notice that there's anything wrong with your son. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until I started getting calls from school. Now, he had gone through freshman, sophomore, and junior year. I never got a call from school about his behavior. He was a good student, a good athlete. And then in his senior year, about October of November of his senior year, I got a call from the headmaster. And from that point on, things started spiraling out of control.
I want to ask you about the sort of treatment course that you helped your son Zachary take. But let me turn to Joanne Peterson and ask you, Joanne, about your son. How was he first introduced to opiates?
It was right around after he had graduated from high school. He had played many sports, and you know, he was a good student. And Just like Louise said, the same thing. I had, back in those days, no one had ever really heard of OxyContin. That was what was seeping under the doorways of so many families. And so it's really hard to catch because there's no smell to it. And the symptoms to me, I thought he was going through some sort of mood disorder because he'd be up all night and sleep all day. Suddenly he lost all his ambition, wasn't wanting to really do anything that he used to do. We were always a very athletic family and did a lot together. And, you know, he was sort of isolating, and I thought it was depression. So, you know, it was really tough to figure out what was truly going on. And it did begin with the prescription, an experiment at an underage drinking party.
And so how did you get to the bottom of it? I mean, what led to your understanding of what was going on with your son?
It took a little bit of time to figure it out. After taking him to crisis centers and such, they sent me home with lithium and sleeping pills telling me he had bipolar, but in fact he was using heroin. So, and I didn't know that, but I did. There was one day where he wasn't responding to me when he was sitting on my couch, and I called his name and he didn't respond, and I went over to him and nudged him. And when his head came up, his eyes rolled into the back of his head, and then I knew I was dealing with some sort of drug, and I just didn't know what.
Oh, boy. So let me ask you then, if I could, both of you, about sort of courses of treatment. And I'll come back to you, Louise Griffin. Mm-hmm. When you realized that your son needed treatment, what happened? Could you find treatment easily?
When I realized that Zachary had a problem, he actually ended up confessing to me that he was having a difficult time with prescription pills. So I actually did not know where to turn, and I started looking on the internet for programs. Didn't know too much about it. I actually learned to cope at that time, which is the organization that Joanne has started for many of us. Went online. I found a program at Children's Hospital in Boston. There isn't one of the problems, and I think Joanne would also mention it, there's not a lot of treatment for adolescents.
Mm-hmm.
So the only program that I could find at the time was at Children's Hospital in Boston. I brought him to that program. It's an 8-week, one day a week outpatient kind of program. He went through it. Of course, like most naive parents that go through this, I thought he was cured. Unfortunately, I soon found out he wasn't.
Sure. I mean, an addiction like this, one day a week for a few weeks of an outpatient program, Joanne Peterson, it sounds like this kind of addiction obviously requires much more.
It absolutely does. And just like Louise said, the first detox where I brought my son way back then, I thought that would be the cure myself. And then families and parents, and they find out the hard way that it's probably the first of many. And it's a process. It takes quite a while for somebody to really have the will to get better once they're heavily addicted to the pills. And then they turn to the heroin most of the time as well. So it's a really devastating issue for the family. You blame yourself right away and wonder what you did wrong. We see families at all 12 of our chapters that are just devastated. They took good care of their children. They had dinner with their children. They talked to their children about alcohol and drugs. And that these prescriptions, you know, starting in the late 90s, early 2001, they just hit without any warning. The police weren't prepared. Parents weren't prepared. And it just became this huge... Well, it's been an epidemic for a long, long time. I've been doing this for 10 years, but this is the worst I've ever seen.
Mm. And what do you think explains it? I remember doing some reporting on this. You said this has been going on for a long, long time. I think when I started doing reporting on this was a good 15 years ago, and there was a lot of talk then about very, very cheap and very, very pure heroin.
Mm-hmm.
Is that still one of the main reasons that this is happening?
It seems to have really started when OxyContin hit the market, because it was prescribed very, very widely prescribed, and the marketer of OxyContin told doctors in the pain community that it was safe for moderate pain, when in fact it wasn't. When you crushed an OxyContin 80 milligram back in those days, it was equivalent to taking 16 Percocets.
Mm.
So it addicted people very quickly when they experimented.
Listeners, we're talking to Joanne Peterson. She's the founder and executive director of Learn to Cope, a support group for parents and family members dealing with a loved one addicted to heroin, OxyContin, and other drugs. Also with us is Louise Griffin. Her son, Zachary, passed away 8 months ago from a drug overdose in Florida. She's established a chapter of a support group called Grief Recovery After a Substance Passing. That's also called GRASP in Lowell, Massachusetts. You can join the conversation. Are you a parent, sibling, a friend of someone struggling with opiate addiction? If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Louise, if I could just sort of complete the story about Zachary. He ended up in a sober home in Florida. The reading that I've done, it sounded like he was on his way, on a road toward recovery. What happened?
He was. Zachary, as Joanne said, it's not one and done. For the most part, some people may achieve recovery after one, but it really does. It's like a roller coaster. So they'll go into detox, they go in treatment, which is lasts no longer than 30 days, and then they sometimes do an outpatient program if they can sustain that recovery period. So we went through many periods with Zachary. He finally told me he was ready to get it. And at that point, I looked for some treatment options in Massachusetts. And one thing, when the addict's ready, treatment must be ready for them. Mm-hmm. At the time, it was around February or March of last year, he was ready. We looked for opportunities in Massachusetts. Unfortunately, all of the treatment centers and the beds were full. So I had known about some programs, and once again, from going to Learn to Cope, there were a lot of folks that had sent their children down to Florida. I was aware of some and investigated some potential opportunities for him. We found one and sent him. He went down to Florida. He was in recovery for 60 days. He seemed to be turning his life around, finally had a job, and called me on day 60. He was so proud of himself for achieving 60 days of sobriety. Had a nice group of friends. Next day, I came home. The Lowell Police Department was at my door to tell me that my son had passed away. Mm. So do I know what happened? I don't. And I think most, even those in recovery, may say they're not really sure what triggers, but something triggered my son. And I really don't know what at this point.
Sure. I'd like to talk about some of the lessons that I know you are both well-versed in. I mean, one of the issues that seems to get in the way of really sort of accepting this sort of society-wide is this idea of the stigma, and how the stigma of opiate addiction and drug addiction sort of gets in the way of having an open conversation and really an open discussion about what needs to happen. Louise, let me start with you on that. How did you sort of see this idea of the stigma playing out?
So I think that instead of looking at this epidemic as a public health crisis, many people, and I shouldn't generalize, I'll just say how I felt, mm-hmm. was one of not in my family. I've often said to people, and I'll say it again, if my son had cancer, people would have been lining up at my door to give me casseroles. Mm-hmm. When they found out my son was addicted or had an addiction disease, people could have not run away from me fast enough. I've also said, and Joanne knows, that this is the loneliest disease. It's lonely for a family because it's not just the addict or the addicted person that experiences the disease. It's the family also. And we truly need support. We need a place to go. I think stigma is because people think of a drug addict, I've said before, as a lower life form, and they're not. They're human beings, and I think we need to put a face on this terrible disease. It's baffling. People don't understand it. And I think the other thing is most addicts turn to criminal activity to support their habit, and then what happens is the addicted person ends up in the criminal justice system, which now has become becomes the road for recovery, and it just is not the right place to be treating these people. Mm. They don't need a prison. They need a recovery program.
Right. Joanne Peterson, you've had experience with the way this addiction epidemic has been stigmatized, right?
Absolutely. Even today, you know, every time, you know, one of us might speak out or there's an article written at the bottom, you'll read all the comments, let them die. They're just addicts. They're mm-hmm. just, you know, losers. We don't need them anymore. And these are people's children, brothers, sisters, like Louise said, and it's not a moral disease. It's a disease. It may not be something that someone's born with, but it certainly is something that people develop. And if you could see our meetings, it doesn't matter what zip code you live in, what type of career you have, how well you've parented your sons or daughters. These drugs are just everywhere right now. So, yes, there is still stigma out there. It's gotten better than it used to be, but it does still happen. I was at a meeting last night where it was happening, and somebody was up speaking saying, you know, if you have dinner with your kids and get them in sports, you know, and take good care of your children, they'll be okay. And, you know, that's really doing a disservice to the public, because most of these kids, we did have dinner with them and had them in sports, and that didn't cure anything.
Let's take a couple of calls, Louise and Joanne. Let's go to Alex, who's calling from Nashua, New Hampshire. Hi, Alex. You're on the air. What's on your mind?
Yeah, hi. I just want to start out by thanking, I didn't catch her name, but the founder of Learn to Cope,
That's Joanne Peterson, yep.
Yeah, Joanne, thank you so much for founding that group. It's been a huge help to my family and my brother as we've been going through this for, you know, about a year now. Yeah, I just wanted to say quickly, I have a younger brother who's an addict in his early 20s, and he's been in treatment for about a year. And one thing I sort of noticed, or I'm starting to feel more powerfully now, is that, like, you know, he's still kind of a young kid, and he's part of this group of people who thought they had, you know, at least 10 years to party, to go wild, and to drink, and not really overthink it. And now they're being told that they have to go to a 12-step program where they can't touch any substances ever again. I mean, I don't know if they're all that forceful, but I think that's the message that my brother's getting. So, you know, it's really isolating. Like, he has to tell himself, like, his youth, his young adulthood is, like, over, and that just compounds the kind of mental stress that he's going through. And I got to thinking that it'd be nice for there to be more events across the city that care not just to addicts, but to everyone. And they're just, like, sober events without, you know, even mentioning the fact that, like, addicts go, just because they're basically in that community 24/7. One thing my brother said when I asked him if it was just like a job, he started doing this full time now. He said it's not like a job, because when you have a job, you have vacation, you have breaks.
Right. So this is a job that you just have to absolutely stick to. Louise, you're nodding your head. You agree with Alex?
I absolutely agree with everything that he's saying. And I think, you know, I think one thing that will help is, as this becomes more accepted and we continue the discussion, more and more recovery communities are going to be formed. There are some great recovery communities. You know, we have to get back to, you don't need alcohol. I'm sorry. I know you may be young. But you don't need alcohol just to have fun. And I mean, there are ways that we can all enjoy life. It's no different than a diabetic has to stay away from sugar, or, you know, a person that has heart disease. They have to make some changes in their lives. But, you know, just remember, for your brother and for yourself, recovery is possible, and he can have a great, great life.
Alex,
and I wish him luck.
Alex, thanks so much for the call.
Thank you, Alex.
Joanne, let me come to you, because Alex made mention to Learn to Cope, which you started as you were struggling to figure out recovery options for your son. Why don't you tell us a little bit about Learn to Cope?
Learn to Cope, we've been around since 2004, so this is our 10th year, and we have 12 chapters across the state. And we have a website, which is www.learn2cope.org. On our website, we have a private discussion board, which is actually national. There's over 5,000 people there. And on the private piece of the board, families are able to communicate and get hope and resources and support there. We're also a pilot for Narcan for the Department of Public Health.
Mm-hmm.
So we give out Narcan and train for Narcan at every single chapter every week. And we've had 23 parents reverse overdoses since December of 2011.
And just to be clear for our listeners, Narcan is something that can be sprayed up the nose that will essentially reverse the effects of an overdose.
Correct.
Right.
Correct.
Let's take another call. Debbie is calling from Lowell, Massachusetts. Debbie, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I am a teacher at the high school level, and I'm just wondering what we can do. I mean, sometimes we do have referral people in place, but sometimes a kid doesn't want to go there and doesn't want to talk to anybody else. But you sense a problem. You know something's going on, and you don't quite know what to do.
Debbie, it's a great question. Joanne, let me put that to you first.
I've I do a lot of prevention events at the schools to parents and to administration and to teachers and school nurses. And what I do is I teach them the strange things that you might find in the bathrooms of the school or parents might find in their home that it's like a puzzle, really. There's so many weird little things that you might find. And I'm a big fan of home drug testing kits. So what I would, I don't know if you can do this as a teacher, but if you do suspect someone's using drugs, you might want to call their parents and tell them that they may want to investigate and see if maybe there might be something going on and that there are home drug test kits available at local pharmacies. And I know they might not be happy with hearing that from you, but it's better to do that and have them not happy with you than not say anything. And then that way down the road, the sooner somebody can intervene and get their sons or daughters to treatment, the better the chances are that they'll be able to find recovery.
And Louise, let me ask you about Zachary. Were there any indications perhaps coming from his school that something was amiss?
Absolutely. Debbie, I'm not sure if you're Lowell High School, but my son was a student at Lowell High School. And it was a few years ago, but at Lowell High, the only thing that I would suggest, Lowell High, and you know what, I have nothing bad to say. Lowell High was a great high school, and I'd send my children back there in a minute. I think what has to happen, though, I think guidance counselors and I think the counselors themselves need to be educated about the signs and what to look for. I know when Zachary had been introduced, well, Zachary took a Percocet. I don't want to blame anybody else for what he did. But when I went to visit the counselor at Lowell High, he had such a high caseload. Zachary had not been a problem for 3 years, so basically said, there's not much we can offer you. But I think it's just if there's education and there are things, information within the schools to help guide parents. For instance, I didn't know that Learn to Cope was operating then. I mean, I found that out on my own. Actually, I found out because Joanne came to the school and did a presentation. But there needs to be more of that available in the high schools, and I think there has to be much more awareness, even for the students to understand that just because it's a prescription pill prescribed by a doctor does not mean it's not harmful. And I think, I know, even myself, I thought because it was a prescription pill, I told my son to knock it off, did not really realize what he was going through, and then did the traditional things, took the phone and the car away from him.
Right.
But I think we need to like really bring this out in the high school, and even before high school, this has got to get into the middle schools.
Let's take another call. Anne is calling from Waltham. Anne, you're on the air.
Hi, yes. I just want to talk a little bit about how these kids get access to it. My daughter is 19, and she's been struggling with it for a little over a year. In and out of detox 4 or 5 times. Finally got her in a residential program. And what happens is they take the girls to an AA meeting every night. And as, you know, most people will tell you who are in recovery, that's essential to getting them straight. And there are vans that hang out in the parking lots where there are AA meetings. And what happened was all the girls went to a meeting. One of them snuck out, went right over to the van, got some heroin, shared it with 6 of the other girls, and they all used, and they all got kicked out. And, you know, she made that terrible decision to use, but now she's back on the street again.
So, Anne, you're describing literally van loads of drug dealers hanging out right outside of AA meetings.
Exactly. I mean, it happens all the time, and that's one of the many ways that these kids get it. I mean, the access is just ridiculous, and obviously these guys are predators, you know, who are hanging out there, but what a market, you know?
Right, Anne. Well, thank you for putting that on the table, and we wish you all the best with your daughter, Joanne Peterson. What Anne is describing sounds like a terrible combination of events.
Well, I do want to say one thing is the AA meetings, not all of them are wonderful, but most of them are wonderful. That does obviously happen, and that can happen anywhere. There's vans of people at Walmart parking lot. They're just everywhere. But as far as where are these pills coming from and where is the heroin coming from, the pills, there's different avenues. There's traffickers that go to other states and go and visit these what we call pill mills, where anyone can walk in and they don't even need an x-ray, and they can walk out with loads of prescriptions, and they can just visit several of them, and then they come back here and they sell them for a lot more money than they're worth down south. Also, there's doctor shoppers. I had taken a photo at the Weymouth Police Station. They had a table with about 30 prescription bottles on the table, and that was from one person visiting several doctors. And that was for the 30-milligram oxycodone pills that we hear about so much. They call them Perc 30s on the street, which they're actually not Percs at all. They're oxycodone, rapid-release 30-milligram pills. They can also get them out of, you know, medicine cabinets where there's been a lot about, there's been cases with district attorney's offices where, you know, someone may come into a home that's to repair something and go through medicine cabinets and get it that way. Or there's just so many different avenues. There's really not one stop shop when it
so
comes to that.
So it sounds like being maximally aware of these many avenues is a key to sort of understanding this problem and dealing with it. Joanne Peterson, our time is running out, but I want to ask you one question. I want to know how your son is doing. I understand he's been in recovery for about 8 years.
He's been in recovery for a long time. He's married now with children. He does very well. There was, you know, a bump at one time in the road, but he knew exactly what he needed to do, and he did it. And he's clean and sober, and that's the key. I mean, when he was very young, it was tough to be, you know, to never have a drink of alcohol. So by the time he turned 25, he wasn't sure. You know, he said that was never his problem. So, you know, they usually find out quickly that if they have alcohol, it will bring them back to something else. So, you know, they call it buying another seat on the Titanic, really.
Right. Well, Joanne Peterson, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, having this important conversation. She's the founder and executive director of Learn to Cope. That's a support group for parents and family members dealing with drug addiction. Joanne, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Louise Griffin. She's established a chapter of a support group called Grief Recovery After Substance Passing. That's GRASP in Lowell. Louise Griffin, all the best to you, and thank you as well.
Thank you.
Listeners, stay with us. There's more to come. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.